Thank you for listening to this sermon from MCA Church. If you'd like to learn more about what's going on in our community, head to our website at mcachurch.ca. Thanks for listening.
Good morning. I love Easter Sunday. And if ever anyone needs proof that miracles can happen, just look at Pastor Brendan. He's dressed better than I am today. I love Easter Sunday. There is a joy to the morning, an undercurrent of life and power that echoes the events of what happened on that first Easter Sunday. You're likely familiar with the events. On Good Friday, Jesus was crucified on a Roman cross for crimes he did not commit. His body was laid in a tomb, and there in front of the tomb, a large stone was rolled in front to block the entrance. And there his dead body lay through the evening on Friday and the night, day and night on Saturday. And then on Sunday morning, a group of women, they go to the tomb to pay their respects. But when they get there, the stone had been rolled away from the entrance of the tomb, and the tomb, it was empty. And Mary Magdalene, she was the first to see the risen Jesus with her own eyes, but she couldn't believe her eyes. None of us would have believed our eyes. But then the risen Jesus, he appeared to Thomas and to Peter and to the rest of the disciples and to many others, and they were all gobsmacked. The only thing they could say, "He is risen. He's risen indeed." This morning, I want to lead you beyond the events of that first Easter in order to behold the effect of Easter. I want to lead you to see what the effect that first Easter had in your very own life, your life here, right now, today. I want to lead you beyond the events to see the effect that first Easter has in your living and breathing and waking. History has proven that the events of Easter have had a profound effect on the world. The events of Easter have had this profound effect, a life-changing, world-altering effect on the world as we know it. Take, for instance, a man by the name of Rodney Snark. He is a historian, a sociologist at Baylor University. And he makes the convincing case that the belief in the resurrection of Jesus was the single most significant historical event ever to hit human civilization. And here's the proof he gives. He says that our modern-day charities and hospitals and humanitarian aid efforts and social movements that empower the poor and the marginalized, those societies today, they can all trace their roots back to the early church and their belief in the resurrection. Fascinating. From a secular university and a secular historian, belief in the resurrection, the events of that first Easter, they have had a profound effect on our world today. And I want to help you see the profound, life-changing effect that the events of that first Easter have in your life, right here, right now. And in order to get us there, I want to begin with a picture. It's a picture that you've already had painted for you this morning. It's a picture that the prophet Ezekiel is given in Ezekiel chapter 47. Now, some of you have been coming to Easter Sunday services for the better part of your life. And maybe for some here, you've attended over 60, maybe even 70, maybe even 80 Easter Sunday services. But I'm willing to guess. No, scratch that. I'm willing to bet that in all the 80 years of coming to Easter Sunday services, you have never heard an Easter Sunday sermon preached from the text of Ezekiel 47. But boy, is it the perfect text that gives us a picture of the effect that first Easter Sunday has in the lives of people. Let me lead you into the picture. The prophet Ezekiel, he was taken by the hand by a messenger of God. and he is taken by the hand, and the messenger, he shows Ezekiel a picture, and it's a picture of the temple of God. And out of the temple flows from the threshold this trickle of water that flows and flows out of the temple. And as it flows out, it goes down the stairs into the city. It fills up the city. And then the messenger takes Ezekiel by the hand, and he leads him into what now is a river. And he leads him first into a river that is only up to his ankles. But the messenger leads him deeper still into the waters. He takes a few more steps, and now he's up to his knees. But the messenger leads him deeper still. The river comes up to his waist. And the messenger's not done there. He leads him even further still, and now the river is above his head. He's in over his head. It's a vast river, so big that someone can swim in it. It's too big for anyone to cross, we're told. And as the river flows out of the temple through the city, we're told that it goes to the Dead Sea. Now, the thing you need to understand about the Dead Sea is that it is dead. It's where it got its name. In fact, even today, the Dead Sea is comprised of over 30% salt. Nothing can live in its waters. It is inhospitable to life. But the river flows from the temple of God in through the city, and it goes to the Dead Sea. And we're told everything it touches comes to life. The sea becomes this fresh water, and it's filled with teams of swimming creatures, fish, and trees grow on either side of the river, trees that spring up and produce fruit. And we get the great refrain. It's right in the middle of the picture, this great refrain in verse 9 of Ezekiel 47, and it says this: wherever the river flows, life abounds. Wherever the river flows, life abounds. What a picture. Let me lead you a little deeper into the picture. There are three things that I want you to note. First, there is the desert, a desolate place where nothing grows. And we see the desert most clearly, of course, in the Dead Sea. But there is another desert of sorts at play in this passage, a metaphorical desert. You see, the people to whom this picture was given, they were living in a desert season. They had once known joy and flourishing in the city of Jerusalem, a life where they lived under God's leadership, and it was a life of flourishing and abundance. But the nation of Babylon had been risen up and invaded the city of Jerusalem, tore down its walls, burnt down the temple, sacked the city, and carried off the people of God into exile in Babylon. These were people in despair, the ones to whom this picture is given. They were in a season where life felt lifeless, just like the Dead Sea. And the reason for their desert was because of sin. Sin had built a dam between God and his beloved people. The people had rejected God's goodness and his leadership in their lives, and life became a desolate wasteland, a desert. And that's always what happens when we reject the giver of life. Life suffers. We experience desert. At one point in the book of Ezekiel, these people, they are described as a valley of dry bones. Just picture that. A people who are living like a valley of dry bones. It's a picture of where sin had led them, to a desolate desert, devoid of life, cut off from the presence of God. Which brings us to the second thing to note in the picture. First was the desert, but second is the temple. At first, the temple. At first, we know in the story of Israel, the temple was called a tabernacle, which simply meant a tent. Hold on to that. But now, here, we have a picture of a temple, which is the tabernacle just built with stone. And the temple was the place where in the Old Testament, God chose to dwell upon the earth. He dwelt upon the earth in the temple. The temple was the place where God's living presence resided. It was the place of heaven upon the earth. And that's why the Israelites were so distraught in their desert, of course, because the temple in Jerusalem had been destroyed. The place of God's presence residing among them had been destroyed. They were cut off from his presence. And at the forefront of the picture that Ezekiel gives to these people in the desert is a picture of the temple, the place of God's presence. And then from the temple, we have, from the door of the temple, this water is flowing out. And it's flowing, and it's flowing into the city, and it's flowing, and it becomes a river. But not just any river. It's a river of life. That's the third thing to note. The river of life. The river flows out of the temple, the place of God's presence, and everything it touches springs to life. The Dead Sea comes alive and trees come to bloom and bear fruit. Wherever the river flows, life abounds. And the abundant life here in this picture, it is represented by a series of trees. Did you catch that? Trees. We need to take note of the trees in this picture. They're important. We're told that the trees, they bear fruit, not just once a season like most trees, but they bear fruit once a month. And their leaves, we're told in Ezekiel 47, their leaves bring healing to people. Wherever the river flows, life abounds. Now, get this, mark this, people. The picture in the middle of the Bible, in Ezekiel 47, is the same picture at the very end of the Bible, in the very last chapter, when we are given a picture of God's intended destiny for his creation. It's the same picture we get in Revelation chapter 22, verses 1 and 2. Listen. Then the angel showed me the river of the water of life, as clear as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb, down the middle of the great street of the city. And on each side of the river stood the tree of life, bearing 12 crops of fruit, yielding its fruit every month. And the leaves of the tree are for the healing of the nations. It's the same picture. The river of life. It's flowing from the presence of God where Jesus is. And the tree is bearing fruit for the healing of the nations. And the tree, we're told in Revelation 22, is described as what? The tree of life. The tree of life. The tree of life. Does that ring a bell? The tree of life. We're introduced to the tree of life at the very beginning of the story of the Bible. It's in Genesis chapter 2 and chapter 3, the tree of life. You see, what we need to understand about the Bible is that the Bible is telling us a story. It's telling us a true story. It's telling us a true story about the cosmos and every person who is in it. And at the beginning of the story is the tree of life. And at the end of the story is the tree of life. But in the middle of the story are people who are walking in the desert, cut off from the giver of life. And in the midst of the story, they are given a picture, a hope-filled promise picture, that from the temple of God, the river will flow and bring life and healing to the nations. What a picture. Wherever the river flows, life abounds. And what we need to understand about the tree of life is that it doesn't simply represent biological life. It represents a different kind of life. You see, in Greek, the language that the New Testament is written in, there are two Greek words for the word life. The first is the Greek word bios. It's where we get our word biology from. It refers to biological life. that which we can see living and breathing and growing. And bios is what we get when we are born. It is the kind of life that we get when we are born, and it needs to be sustained through air and water and food, but for a time. Because in the end, bios life, it runs out. It runs its course. It decays. It dies. But there is another word for life. The second Greek word for life is zoe. And it's the word used in Revelation 22 about the tree of life. Zoe is a different kind of life. Zoe is the life that God has. It is the life that God is. Zoe is the life that God experiences in perfect relationship as Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. It is the life that He has. It is the life that He is. And Zoe is the animating life that does not decay. It does not run out. It is a life that cannot die, for it is the very life of the living, eternal God. Zoe is the kind of life that breathes into human beings their purpose and their meaning and their destiny. It breathes into us our identity. It breathes into us beauty and goodness and healing and inspiration and joy. Wherever the river flows, life abounds. Wherever the river flows, the Zoe life of God abounds. Are you getting the picture? What a picture. You see, Ezekiel's picture has everything to do with us today. Zoe life. It's the kind of life we're thirsty for. We're thirsty for Zoe life because we know what it's like to live in the desert of life apart from God. We know what it's like to live as broken people in a world that is broken by sin. And we thirst. We thirst for a quality of life that is more than biological. We thirst for a life of purpose and meaning and identity. We thirst for beauty and goodness and healing. We thirst for inspiration and joy. We thirst for Zoe life in our relationships and in our families and in our marriages. We thirst for this quality of life in the work that we do and in the rest that we enjoy. We thirst for the Zoe life of God in our quiet moments when we're all alone, and we thirst for it in the midst of our frantic, busy schedules. We thirst for the greater life that God has. And so we find ourselves in the picture of Ezekiel chapter 47. We find ourselves there longing for the river of life to flow into ours. Are you with me? Where do you long for the river of God's Zoe life to flow in you? And here is the good news. The good news is that the picture is a promise that God has fulfilled in Jesus Christ. We read about it in John chapter 7. Let me take a moment to orient you to that part of the Bible story. In John chapter 7, we're told that it is the last day of a week-long festival called the Feast of Tabernacles. I told you you'd need to hold on to that word, tabernacles. It's the last day in a feast called the Feast of Tabernacles. Now, this feast was the most joy-filled celebration of the calendar year for the people of God. You need to think Christmas plus Easter plus Thanksgiving all together on steroids. Okay? We got a picture of the Feast of Tabernacles. And the celebration at the Feast of Tabernacles revolved around three things. Any guesses to what they are? The desert. The tabernacle, which is also the temple. and a flow of living water. The Feast of Tabernacles was celebrated first to remember the people of God's time in the desert, when God had rescued them from slavery in Egypt. And during the ceremony, they lived in these tents. They were called tabernacles. They would be out on their porch or on their roofs, and they would all not live indoors. They would live outdoors in these tents, these tabernacles. It was a reminder of how God's presence dwelt among them in the desert, in the tabernacle, which later became the temple, how he dwelled among them in the temple. And each morning, of all the 7 mornings during the festival, they would celebrate a water ceremony. And the water ceremony was a reminder of how God had provided water, life-giving water in the desert. But it also didn't just look back to remember, it looked forward. It looked forward to a time when God would bring his life-giving water to the earth again. A time when he would pour out his life-giving spirit upon people. And so, each morning, for 7 days, the priest would go down to the pool of Siloam, and he would draw into his pitcher, a golden pitcher. He would fill it full with water from the pool, and he would march to the temple with the pitcher of water to the sounds of trumpets and flutes. And people would line the streets, and they would sing songs as the priest took the water to the temple. And they would shake in one hand these palm branches, and in another hand, these dried-out citrons. And when the priest would reach the altar, he would take the pitcher of water, and he would pour it onto a bowl on the altar, and everyone would start singing and cheering and playing their musical instruments. Rabbis from around the first century, they describe the festival this way. They say, "He who has not seen the rejoicing of the water drawing has never seen joy in his life." This was a raucous celebration. And so imagine with me that you are there. All of this is going on. People line the streets with trumpets and flutes. And there's joy and celebration, and there you are. It's the last and greatest day of the festival, we're told in John chapter 7. And you followed the priest down to the pool of Siloam, and you watched him draw the water out of the well. And you hold up your palm branches and your citron, and you begin to shout shouts of joy. You join the celebration. And you follow the priest walking up the streets to the altar, and you watch him as he pours the water out into the bowl, and now you begin to sing with delight with the rest of the people in anticipation of God pouring out water of his life-giving spirit into the world. And then out of the corner of your eye, you see a man stand up, and it's Jesus. And he shouts in a loud voice over the celebrating, and he says these words, "Let anyone who is thirsty come to me and drink. Whoever believes in me, as Scripture has said, rivers of living water will flow from within them." Whoa. Can you imagine the moment? Let anyone who is thirsty come to me and drink. Let anyone who is thirsty for life, for the Zoe life of God, come to me and drink. Whoever believes in me, Jesus says, rivers of living water will flow from within them. The Zoe life of God, his life-giving spirit, will flow from within them. You see, in Jesus Christ, the picture of Ezekiel 47 is being fulfilled. Through Jesus, the presence of God is being poured out on people living in a desert wasteland apart from God. The river of life is flowing from the temple of God into every city, over every people. Wherever the water flows, life abounds. Jesus is the fulfillment of the promise. Now, herein lies the effect of Easter. I told you I wanted to lead you to show you what the effect of those events have in your life here today. Herein lies the effect of Easter. On that first Easter weekend, the dam that kept us living in the desert apart from the Zoe life of God was burst. And the water of God began to flow into the world. That first Easter, the dam of sin that keeps us separated from the God of life, was dismantled by Jesus on the cross. And now we've been given access to the very Zoe life of God. Jesus bursts open the dam, and now the river of God's life is made available to all who would receive it. Do you know how I know? Do you know how we know this is true? Because Jesus rose from the dead. Because of the resurrection. The resurrection is the proof of the promise. The resurrection was the first sign that the water was flowing into the world. The Zoe life of God was flowing into the sin-riddled desert of the world. When his buried body began to breathe, the river of life was flowing. And now Jesus offers the same living water to all who would receive it. To all who would receive it. Where the river flows, life abounds. In John 7, Jesus says, "Let anyone who is thirsty come to me and drink, and rivers of living water will flow from within them." Not flow from the temple, but flow even from within the people of the world who turn their hearts to Jesus. Isn't that incredible? In Revelation 21, at the end of the story, Jesus says, "To the thirsty, I will give water without cost from the spring of the water of life." The water is given without cost, though it cost Jesus everything to give it. It is given freely to sinner and saints alike. It doesn't matter what you've done. It doesn't matter where you've been. The water is made available to all who would receive it from Jesus. The effect of that first Easter is that now, here today, in this very moment, people, God's powerful, life-giving, people-transforming, heart-healing, holy-producing, joy-evoking spirit is available to everyone who is thirsty. So let me ask, are you thirsty? Are you thirsty? I'm thirsty. I'm spitting like crazy up here. That's why I'm thirsty. I'm thirsty for more of God. And I know that you're thirsty too. Are you thirsty to be filled with the purpose, meaning, and identity that comes in the flow of the river? Are you thirsty to be filled with the beauty and the goodness and the healing and the inspiration and joy that is found only in the Zoe life of God? Jesus has it. His resurrection proves it. And he's offering it to you today. And so, church, are you ready to dive into the water? People, are you ready to step into the water for the first time? In Ezekiel's picture of the river, it begins only being ankle deep. For some of you here today, you need to take your first step into the river, to open your heart to God, to open your life to Jesus and his leadership, to receive the forgiveness he extends to you through his work on the cross. Today, you need to step into the river to bring your pain, disappointment, your regrets into the river of God. It's safe. He wants to wash over you a love that you have never quite known before. He wants to fill you with his Holy Spirit. But then the river gets deeper, up to the knees, to the waist, and over our head. Church, Jesus is calling us to go in over our head. He's calling you to go deeper into the living water. He's calling you to go deeper in an encounter of faith and trust, deeper into an encounter of his holiness, deeper into his mission, his healing, a deeper encounter of his profound love. And so, church, as we sit on this Easter Sunday, under the effect of what happened on that first Easter Sunday, May you be filled with the power and the joy that comes through the risen Jesus, because where the river flows, there is life. And friends, the joy of the Feast of Tabernacles, it's got nothing on the joy of Easter. The dam that keeps us from the life of God has been burst, and the living water of God is now aflow. Wherever the river flows, life abounds. Church, if you're thirsty, people, if you want to step into the water, will you stand with me as I pray? Jesus, oh yes, Jesus. We have no idea the dynamic power at work in our world, because God, we don't always see things clearly. But Jesus, on that first Easter Sunday, the power of God, the Spirit of God, the living water of God filled your body in a way with a life that we want to experience. And so Jesus, where we have fallen dead, bring us to life. Where there is sin and desert, we pray that you would bring your living waters into our dead sea and bring us to life. Jesus, where we have become content and complacent, bring the sweet water of God to enliven and inspire us. And where those who are walking with hurt and wounds, bring the tree of life, the tree of healing. And God, we don't know how you presume to work in everyone's life. So we simply open ourselves to the living water, and we step into the river, and we say, we are yours. Enliven us with our spirit. You are worthy of worship. Let's worship together.